Welcome to Enabled, the weekly program about people just like you who are dealing with issues of vision loss. The program is designed to encourage you through news you can use, inspirational stories, and interviews. I'm Nancy Zimmer, your host for Enabled. Thank you for joining me. Aren't leftovers wonderful? I was in heaven last week eating leftovers for lunch. Well, when I do research for this program, I also get leftovers, really good articles that just don't fit into the original program. So today, I have some delectable, delightful, and delicious program leftovers for you. Topics will include white canes, a feisty lady, a book review, and accessibility phone numbers. You might want to get a pencil handy for that last one. But first, we'll talk about white canes. This comes from a website called thinkingoutloud.com. This is a blog, a weblog. It's one person's opinion. And the headline reads, Bright versus White, the Cane Debate. The blog, by the way, was written by someone who calls herself Sassy Pants. She starts out by saying, there is an interesting debate in the visually impaired world as to whether a cane, which is that long white metal object used by visually impaired people to get around safely, whether this cane should stay white or be colorful to represent a person's individuality. Here are the arguments that I have come across. Four. This would be arguments for changing the cane to be more colorful. Her number one argument, people should be allowed to show their individuality. Another one, a cane should be seen as an accessory as well as an aid. Visually impaired people will feel more comfortable using a cane if it's colored. Those that already own a colored cane have received compliments on their colorful or their sparkly cane. If having canes in different colors encourages children to use them, adults and parents are more welcoming of it. Next, having a colored cane extinguishes the prejudice of the stereotypical blind person. Another idea, people are too busy in their daily thoughts that they barely pay attention to a person using a cane in the first place, so changing a color would make no difference to the public's ignorance. Another idea she's heard, people recognize the cane for what it is and the action in which it is being used. And finally, colored handle or a colored grip or a colored ball on the cane, but the main part should stay white. It gives individuality while still being a universal symbol. So next we move on to the argument against changing the color of the white cane. Number one, white is the universal color of canes which represent to the public that a person has limited or no vision. Number two, white canes with red stripes will signal visual and hearing impairment. Another against, changing the color would then not distinguish hearing impairments either. Another argument, having different colors means the public will not know what each color represents, and this can therefore confuse the public. Another argument against, the public can barely differentiate between a standard cane and a red and white one. A white cane is part of the universal symbol to the public. It is also part of the highway code. If the color were to change, would drivers take notice and respect the person? If the highway code says to respect a white cane, to change it could potentially make the blind person liable, not the driver or the foot passenger, if an accident were to happen. Visually impaired people, this is another argument, visually impaired people may not get the support from the public if the color of the cane has been changed. And sometimes we need this support. If it were to change, would the public be aware? The public may not be as ready to offer help because they see it as a cool gadget or just an accessory. So, looking at the arguments for and against, it all seems to come down to personal preference, whether to accessorize a cane or not. Essentially, it's a case of what each person deems as a priority. Do they want to look snazzy, to be safe, or both? Personally, if there was an option for changing the grip color and the ball or the tip of the cane and keeping the body of the cane white, I probably would go for that option. For me, I am an individual. And I think it would be nice to show my individuality with something I see as an extension of me. However, I do not agree with having colored canes as a whole. Maybe for young children, first learning to use a cane. but I believe that as the white cane is a universal symbol, it should stay that way. I do agree that generally the public is too caught up in their own busy lives to really notice that you, as a visually impaired person, are even using a cane. But to me, white is the brightest color, can be seen the furthest distance away, and is also the most reflective. So ask yourself, what would you choose? Individuality, accessory, or just plain and simple safety? This column was signed, much love, Sassy Pants. The next article in my pile of leftovers here, the headline reads, "For a half century, she has led the blind with chutzpah and often no cane." This came from the New York Times Character Study series. It was written by Corey Kilgannon and published in March of this year. This article is accompanied by a picture of the subject. Her name is Rosemary Romano. She is dressed in a bright pink sweater worn over a pink and beige print dress, and she's holding her cane in front of her. Her head is crowned with a poof of white hair, and there is a great big smile on her face in the picture. The caption says, "Rosemary Romano, age 79, who is visually impaired, works at Helen Keller Services for the Blind. The main thing I bring to the table," she says, "is that the students see how I function and I get them to realize they can have a life again." The photo was taken by Todd Heisler from the New York Times. The article begins by saying, "It's like the blind leading the blind," said Rosemary Romano, folding up her cane, "but with a positive connotation." Ms. Romano, who is blind, has been leading blind students through life and work lessons for 54 years. As an instructor of typing and assistive technology at a place called the Helen Keller Services for the Blind in downtown Brooklyn, she dispenses tricks and tips, such as where to find the hyphen on the computer keyboard. By the way, that would be the key to the right of the zero, and it's best hit with your right pinky finger. She can also give you suggestions about what keystroke will locate a lost cursor. But more than touch typing, basic Braille, and clerical skills, Ms. Romano's real lessons come from the way she lives her life and leads by example. Here's a quote. "The main thing I bring to the table is that the students see how I function and getting them to realize that they can have a life again," said Ms. Romano, whose determination to maintain a fiercely independent lifestyle includes living on her own in a meticulously neat and impressively decorated apartment in Howard Beach, Queens, and commuting to work by public transportation. She has inspired generations of blind students to become office workers, teachers, and lawyers, and has delayed retiring for years because, she said, "I still had something to bring to the table." But this month at work is her last, and even as she wraps up lessons with her students, she stays firm with them. She has never coddled them. She said, "You're not doing them any good by going easy on them," said Ms. Romano, who summons the style of Ann Sullivan, the indefatigable instructor of Helen Keller, to be a sensitive but stern taskmaster. Still, she said, she can teach her students how to function, but she cannot shape them as people. A quote, "If you were a big-mouthed jerk before, you'll still be a big-mouthed jerk after my class. If you had some class before, you're likely to still have some class." Just then, Chaya Berger, age 30, a visually impaired student at Helen Keller, arrived for a typing lesson with Ms. Romano. She said, "I have never met anyone like her before," said Ms. Berger, a mother and part-time secretary from Borough Park in Brooklyn. Ms. Romano brushed off the compliment, saying, "I've had 54 years of practice." Another instructor at an adjacent training space, Horace Smith, age 52, praised Ms. Romano by saying, "Some students who come in from enclosed worlds and feel sorry for themselves, they only have to meet Rose once and they realize she takes none of that nonsense," he said. Ms. Romano moved around the office with a defiant matter-of-factness to match her personality, often dispensing with her cane. She said, "I am famous for leaving my cane everywhere. When anyone finds a cane around here, they know it's mine," said Ms. Romano, adding that she started working at the school in the early 1960s as a switchboard operator, but quickly became an instructor. She said, I made $50 a week, but I probably would have done it for nothing, she said. A lot of blind people were kept in the background at that time, but I wanted to work. She met her husband, Frank Romano, at the school. He was an administrator and also blind. As a couple, they developed homemaking methods. To match clothes, she would sew braille labels, little braille labels, into his suits and shirts as color indicators. She matched her own clothes by keeping them organized, separating the prints and the solids. Since her husband's death almost 20 years ago, Ms. Romano has drawn on the toughness she learned growing up in the East New York section of Brooklyn. An avid Brooklyn Dodgers fan, she went often to Ebbets Field using a little radio to follow the action on the field. She cheered for her hero, Pee Wee Reese, at shortstop, and drank in the aroma of hot dogs and beer and the surly sounds from the stands. Ms. Romano said you could feel the energy, the thrill of being there. She added that while living at the New York Institute for the Blind in the Bronx, she would listen to those games on the radio. When the New York Giants' Bobby Thompson crushed the Dodgers with his pennant-winning home run in 1951, my mother called the school to see if I was okay, she recalled. Her father, Anthony Marcello, owned the Cactus Pool Room on Rockaway Avenue in East New York, which at the time was a heavily Italian enclave. She said, the mafia guys, when something was about to erupt, they'd tell my father, close up and go home, she recalled. It was part of living there. You didn't ask questions. Her father was a sharp dresser who impressed that quality on his three children. He held Rosemary to the same strict standards as her siblings, which instilled a sense of confident normalcy. To this day, I wouldn't step outside without being all put together, said Ms. Romano, who for years wore suits to work and always looked immaculate, down to her makeup. Weekends are still for shopping and for manicures. She said, some people go to mass. I go to the beauty parlor. The women in there used to treat me like a little glass ornament. It took years to get them to understand that I was a regular person with the same likes and dislikes as anyone else. Now, she said, where did I put my cane? Well, enough talk. It was time for another lesson. If you need to know some of the details, they're called the particulars in this particular article. Her name is Rosemary Romano. She is 79 years old. She is an instructor of the blind who is herself blind. She is from Howard Beach, Queens. And there is a telling detail, a quote from her that says, I've battled my whole life to get people to accept blind people for who they are. And she works at a place called the Helen Keller Services for the Blind. A feisty lady indeed. Next, we have a book review for you. This is about the book called Six Dots, The Remarkable Life and Legacy of Child Inventor Louis Braille. This is a young adult biography by Jen Bryant. The subheadline reads, How a Tenacious Boy Created One of the Most Life-Changing Inventions in Human History. This book review was written by Maria Popova, and it comes from a website called brainpickings.org. It starts out by saying, Communication is health. Communication is truth. Communication is happiness. This is said by Virginia Woolf as she wrote it in contemplating the elemental human need for communication. Indeed, a life deprived of that essential sustenance of the soul, whatever form it may take, is a life of unthinkable tragedy. No cultural hero has delivered more people of that tragedy than Louis Braille. He was born January 4, 1809, died January 6, 1852. Louis Braille, who lost his eyesight at the age of 3 due to an infection following an accident at his father's workshop, then went on to invent the Braille reading and writing system, which forever changed the lives of the blind and the visually impaired. After his groundbreaking invention, he continued to work tirelessly, developing implementations of Braille in mathematics and music, co-creating a precursor of the dot matrix printing machine, and mastering the cello and the organ, which he played professionally at Parisian churches, even as his tuberculosis slowly siphoned away his vitality and finally claimed his life at the age of 43. Helen Keller rightfully compared Braille to Gutenberg, for no other invention since the printing press had transformed the lives of more people who would have otherwise lived bereft of the joy and liberation of reading and learning, their basic human need for communication unmet. But although Braille belongs alongside inventors like Tesla and Edison in impact and legacy, one crucial element sets him apart from, and perhaps even above them. He was an only child when he developed his revolutionary invention, which means he had no training, no funding, no public or institutional support, no commercial motive, no business plan, and only the vision for something life-changing and redemptive, born out of the necessity of a disability that had forever changed his own short life. Here's a quote from the book. In the past several centuries, no one so young has developed something that has had such a lasting and profound effect on so many people. This was written by Jen Bryant, who's the author of the book, which is titled Six Dots, A Story of Young Louis Braille. A wonderful addition. This is a wonderful addition to the Greatest Picture Books About Cultural Heroes series. The book is illustrated by the Brooklyn-based Russian artist Boris Kulikov. The empathy-inviting first-person narrative traces young Braille's immensely inspiring story, beginning with his premature birth, which he survived to be a healthy and curious little boy. Here's a note from the reviewer. The illustrations also are wonderfully warm and expressive, each one often an engaging work of art on its own. But the turning point in Braille's life came when he was three. His father was a leatherer specializing in horse tack in a small town outside of Paris. One day, while playing at the leather workshop, little Louis disregarded his father's admonition not to toy with the sharp tools. Trying to imitate his father, he set out to puncture a piece of leather, but the awl slipped from his tiny hand and stabbed him in the eye. This was the dawn of the 19th century, and medicine, as we know it, was yet to be born. So although a local healer bandaged the boy's eye, and a Parisian surgeon attempted to save it the next day, the damage was permanent. An infection took root and soon spread to his other eye, leaving little Louis in an ongoing agony. By the age of five, he had lost his vision completely. Because Louis was so young when he became blind, his development of theory of mind had not yet reached the point where children become aware that their internal experience is not the universal state of the world. At first, he thought that the world had sunk into a permanent night. He kept asking his parents where the sun had gone. Eventually, he realized that it was his own sight that had disappeared and began learning to navigate the world with the senses that he had left. His father made him a cane. His brother taught him echolocation. His two sisters made him a straw alphabet. The village priest taught him to recognize trees by their touch and birds by their song. And his mother taught him to play dominoes by counting the dots with his fingertips. The adults in his life read books to him, and he went to school with all the other children, where he excelled despite his blindness. But whenever little Louis asked whether there were any books for blind children, he was met with a lamenting no. A local noblewoman was so touched by his story that she wrote a letter to the Royal Institute for the Blind in Paris, beseeching them to accept him. One day, a letter arrived announcing his admission. Although the family had reservations about letting the boy, who was not yet 10 years old, go into the big city alone, his parents placed his happiness and his love of learning above all else, and ultimately sent him to Paris. But when young Louis arrived at the royal school, he didn't need to see to know that there was nothing royal about it. The building had been a prison during the French Revolution, and the conditions for the young pupils were only marginally better. Here's a quote from the book. My hard bed was in a damp, crowded room. My uniform itched. My meals were small and cold. The teachers were strict. The older boys teased and stole. Well, despite his harrowing homesickness, Louis stayed because somewhere in this old, moldy building there were books for the blind. These books were few and precious, so only the best students were allowed to read them. Louis was determined then to become one of the best, and he did. Finally, the day of his dreams arrived, and a book for the blind was placed before him with a ceremonious thud. But to his astonishment, it was a gravely disenchanting experience. The text was written in enormous raised letters so that the blind reader could trace them with their fingertips. Because each sentence took half a page, the books were short and disappointing. He said, "I sighed. Even if I read 100 books like this, how much could I learn?" But the dispirited young Louis soon saw a new frontier of hope. The headmaster delivered news that a French army captain had invented a military communication code using patterns of dots to represent sounds. Louis learned to read the patterns and then to write them using a wooden frame and a metal ruler and punching the dots with a sharp instrument, very much like the awl with which he had blinded himself as a toddler. But although he practiced tirelessly, he eventually grew frustrated that even a short message required a great many dots. Intuiting that the best way to complain is to improve, Louis set out to devise a better system that would allow the blind people to write like the sighted people, one in which the dots represented letters rather than sounds. In a testament to combinatorial creativity, that marvelous way in which our unconscious shakes the tree of memory for fragments of existing ideas, impressions, inspirations, and combines them into something new. I like that word, by the way. In a testament to combinatorial creativity, Louis drew on his childhood memories of his father working on his leather strips with his awl into the night. Here's a quote. "Late at night, while the others slept, I bent over my slate and punched the pages. I tried hundreds of ways to simplify the captain's code. I worked until my back was stiff and my fingers ached. Often I fell asleep a few minutes before morning." Time passed, a year and then two, as Louis continued to work on his code. He was frequently ill from the tuberculosis that would eventually take his life, but he labored through his illness until his writing system was finally ready to be tested. The headmaster read from a library book, and Louis took dictation in dots, and he then read the text back perfectly. Word of his triumph spread throughout the school. His system would soon become a major global alphabet. He was 15. Jen Bryant, the author, chronicles Braille's short yet illustrious life in her book called Six Dots, which is a young adult biography available right now. So finally, we have some accessibility support telephone lines that you should know about. This information came from the publication Eyes Only, put out by the Association for Macular Diseases. I'll read, again, more from this and another program. The accessibility support phone lines. I'll be reading you phone number contacts for Apple, Comcast, Microsoft, AT&T, and two for Verizon. First of all, Apple Accessibility Support Line. The area code is 877-204-3930. This is for use. I'll read the number again at the end, right after I read this information. Apple Accessibility Line is for users of iPhone, iPad, iPod Touch, the Apple Watch, or a Mac. It's a special support line reserved for customers with vision, hearing, motor, and learning impairments. Senior Apple Care specialists are available 24/7 to help you get your accessibility settings right, to answer your questions, and resolve your technical issues. What a blessing. Okay, that's my comment. The number again is 877-204-3930. This is for Apple accessibility. Next, Comcast. This number is 866-668-6703. This is a direct line to a dedicated team specially trained to support customers who rely on their accessibility services, including voice guidance and video description. The Comcast number is 866-668-6703. Microsoft Disability Answer Desk. All the features you need to make your PC visual friendly are built into Windows, but unfortunately many people don't know that. The phone number, I forgot to mention that at the beginning, I'm sorry. The number is 800-936-5900-5900. This is from Microsoft Disability Answer Desk. So Microsoft recognized this as a significant problem, and they put in place a support team specialized in accessibility. So dial them up, 800-936-5900. Next, we have the AT&T National Center for Citizens with Disabilities, AT&T, 866-241-6568. Customers will find out they get free 411 service and also recommendations for mobile phones, providing voice control. AT&T number 866-241-6568. Next, I have two from Verizon. This is their whole center for customers with disabilities. It's 800-974-6006. They will tell you how to get free 411 for your home phone and for your mobile phone. They'll help you arrange the bills to come in a format of your choice. The Vision Center for Customers with Disabilities, 800-974-6006. And the final one, Verizon Wireless National Accessibility Center, 888-262-1999. This number will give you information about accessibility features that make your mobile phone, your tablet, work for you. You can find out about enlarging text, using voice commands, or using the screen reader. This is through Verizon Wireless National Accessibility Center at 888-262-1999. They say, this is from the Eyes Only newsletter, and they will be adding accessibility support numbers as the organization discovers them. This is Eyes Only from the Macula website called www.macula.org. And they do have a phone number, area code 212-605-3719. This is for the Association for Macular Diseases. And I'll keep track of that if they have more of these accessibility support phone lines. So, to end the program today, I will leave you with a quote mentioned just a little while ago as part of that book review. It was Virginia Woolf who said, "Communication is health. Communication is truth. Communication is happiness." Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great week. You've been listening to Enabled, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. Our technical director is Maureen Rich, and I'm Nancy Zimmer. I hope you'll join me again next week for more updates and information and encouraging stories. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can listen to it at our website, wxxi.org.